Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. 2025 marked the 250th birthday of the United States Navy, so for today's bonus episode, we're joined by Dr. Kylie Hulbert to explore the creation of the Continental Navy.
I'm Dr. Kylie Hulbert. I teach at Hampton-Sydney College in Virginia, and I'm a historian of colonial and revolutionary America with a particular interest in the maritime world, the Continental Navy, and American privateers.
The colonial maritime world was about commerce. Raw materials, manufactured goods, and enslaved people moved along ocean trade routes. And in the 1700s, the British Royal Navy ruled the seas. Using its navy, the British were able to create a stronghold for imperial commerce. They established and protected trade routes and defended merchant ships. Colonial ports from Virginia to New England operated within a system built and safeguarded by British economic and naval dominance.
The North American colonies are part of the British Empire. And as part of the empire, they are technically protected by His Majesty's Royal Navy. Now, that's not to say that there aren't ships operating in the coastal waters and in the Atlantic. Of course, there are merchant vessels, there are slave vessels, particularly those sailing from New England. New England is the hub of the maritime world in colonial North America, in the 13 colonies. New England has more harbors, more coastal waterways than some of the southern colonies. But when we're talking about major ports, we're talking about New York, we have Philadelphia, we have Charleston, and then we have the Capes, right? The waters of the Chesapeake off of Virginia. So Virginia, of course, because of its tobacco trade and because of its other trade, utilizes the waterways, has pilots who know those waters like the back of their hand, who are able to maneuver ships through the bays, through the rivers, out into the Chesapeake, and ultimately out into the Atlantic to participate in that Atlantic world of trade. And that Atlantic world of trade includes the Caribbean, it includes Europe. So Virginians are participating in this larger Atlantic world. Colonists are knowledgeable in the maritime world. They have sailed with the British Navy. They have operated on privateering vessels during wars during the 18th century, so the 1700s. So there's definitely a maritime community that is prepared, in a sense, to operate on the waters, but they don't have their own navy per se.
These coastal colonies did have maritime experience, but it could not translate directly into a naval defense at the time of the American Revolution. On land, militias served as a foundation to transition into a continental army, however ragtag it may be. But as the revolution inched nearer, there was no militia equivalent on the water. Colonists certainly had access to ships if they needed, and in fact, there was some grassroots resistance to British ships from colonists aboard whale ships in the early 1770s, but truth be told, they were largely dependent on the Royal Navy as English citizens and would need a concerted effort across the colonies to have a chance against the British fleet. By 1775, there were arguments that the maritime component of the war should not and could not be ignored.
John Adams is one of the first in the Continental Congress to start calling for not only a Continental Navy, but privateering. It's interesting, he calls for both. A lot of people think they have to be separate. They have to be mutually exclusive. You can't have them both at the same time. And Adam says you can, and you have to. His argument is there needs to be a presence on the water. Yes, the Royal Navy is massive. They have about 250 ships at the onset of the revolution. That's huge, huge, biggest navy in the world. And Adam says we need to put ships out to sea to answer that. So he starts calling for the formation of a navy in the summer of 1775. After Washington has been named commander of the Continental Army, Adams is there going, hello, yes, navy, right here, bring in the navy. And other delegates at the Continental Congress balk at this. They don't like this idea because the Continental Army, they could argue, is that extension of the militia. So if you create a Continental Army, it's protection. It is not an act of war. It's not an act of aggression. They're basically saying, we're just protecting ourselves from these British troops that you've been sending in for the last decade. The idea of creating a navy, some of the delegates argue, well, that's the act of a sovereign nation. If the colonies create their own navy, that's basically saying, we're our own thing, we're our own country, we're not part of Britain anymore. And again, it's 1775. So the Declaration of Independence hasn't been signed. They haven't started debating it, despite Adams basically having that in the back of his head that like they might have to. Most people are still thinking reconciliation. So the idea of creating a navy sends people into a bit of a tizzy. They don't like that idea. They're nervous that Britain will take that the wrong way and will see that as an act of war or a declaration of war. So it takes a little while for Adams and some of the other delegates to convince enough people that a navy is necessary.
Eventually, the formation of the Continental Navy gets the go-ahead from the Continental Congress. But the real question is, how are they going to pull that off?
This is exactly the question. Where are you getting the boats? Where are you getting the money? Where are you getting the men? Where are you getting the ammunition, the cannon, the weaponry? You have to build this navy from the bottom up. So that becomes the question for the Congress as well. And the Congress doesn't have a lot of money. They don't have a lot of funds just lying around because the colonies don't really all want to invest in the Continental Congress because it's not supposed to be a government. It's supposed to be this group that is advocating for the colonies. And so they do finally come to a recognition, in a sense, that this navy has to happen. And this really happens in the fall of 1775. The British attack Falmouth, Maine, and the Congress responds in October and says, okay, we're going to purchase two merchant vessels and we are going to fit them out as warships. And then by the end of the month, I think it's October 30th, right before the end of the month, they actually start putting plans into place about, all right, what is this navy going to look like? And then on November 5th, they appoint Isaac Hopkins as commander of the Continental Navy. So by late October, early November of 1775, the Continental Congress has laid forward that they're creating a Continental Navy. But it takes a long time for that navy to come into being. And truthfully, the Continental Navy has moments during the war where it plays an important role.
The Continental Navy certainly had its work cut out for it. It was funded and directed by the Continental Congress on behalf of, and in theory supported by, all 13 colonies. However, several states, Virginia included, maintained their own separate navies to defend their own local waterways. Not exactly a great system. They duplicated effort and strained the already limited resources of money, material, and manpower. To be frank, it's another clear example that these colonies were still adjusting to the idea of a collective union.
The problem was states, they were self-interested. I don't say they're selfish, but they're self-interested. Massachusetts is up in Massachusetts going, well, we're Massachusetts. Like, why should we care about what's going on in Virginia? And Virginia's down here going, well, we're Virginia. Why should we care about what's happening in Rhode Island? We love to think of the revolution as like this moment when we all come together. We're Americans. Woo. We all come together. And in a way we do, but in a way we don't. I mean, I think you just have to look at the Constitutional Convention to realize that not all of these states were in agreement. Not all of the Americans agreed on what this America should look like or what the laws should be or how the government should be structured. And compromise becomes the word of the day at the Constitutional Convention, but it's not the word of the day for the Continental Congress. I mean, the poor Continental Congress throughout the war is sending notes to the states saying, like, please send money. Please send men. You haven't fulfilled your quota. Could you just send like a fraction of it? We'd love it if you just send some supplies. Whatever you can give us. Please, 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 please. It's honestly amazing to me that George Washington and his army and the Continental Navy won the American Revolution. In the grand scheme of things, the British have more ships, they have more men, they have more money. It really comes down to, in a sense, misunderstanding on the side of the British. They don't have a good plan going in. They think that because they are bigger and faster and stronger and have more money, that this is going to be easy and they're just going to be able to go in and knock off these backwater colonial bumpkins. And that clearly is not the case.
Maritime engagements were critical in the success of the American Revolution, but the jury is still out on how effective the Continental Navy and its sailors were on their own. Privateers and international support ended up providing a lot of the naval backbone Washington desperately needed for success. Now, let's pause. Pirate? Privateer? Naval sailor? What's the difference?
A pirate is an illegal raider. A pirate does not have loyalty to any nation, to any particular colony necessarily. A pirate sails, attacks the ships he wants to attack, takes what he wants to take, does not answer to any legal body, and raids at will. Pirates operate during wartime, but they also operate during peacetime. They are out doing their thing whenever they want, however they want, without answering to anybody. So they're outside the law. Privateers require a commission. Privateers have to be legally recognized by a governing body. So during the American Revolution, the Continental Congress eventually writes up commissions for privateers, but individual colonies are also writing commissions for privateers. So before the Continental Congress even brings in privateers, Massachusetts is outfitting privateers, New Hampshire is outfitting privateers. Eventually, most of the colonies are outfitting privateers. So privateers technically operate within the law. They have a commission. They have instructions from their governing body, which tell them what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do. And if they don't follow those instructions, their commission can be revoked and they can be penalized, right? They can be punished for operating outside of their commission. Technically. They have to be caught, you know, and there has to be proof. But technically, they can be punished for that. They also, when they take a prize, they have to bring that prize back to an admiralty court. Their prize has to be adjudicated, and it has to be legally recognized as a prize before they can receive either the goods or the monies or the vessel that they have taken as a prize. So pirates get what they want. They take what they want. Off they go with it. They don't answer to anybody. Privateers have to have that legal recognition in the Admiralty Court. Men who serve on privateers sign articles of agreement, and in those articles of agreement, they are given a particular share of the prize. Then you have sailors in the Continental Navy. Obviously, the Continental Navy is also recognized by a government, is outfitted by a government. Captains in the Navy are given commissions. They're given their vessels. Sailors sign up. In theory, Continental sailors are supposed to receive payment. They're supposed to receive money for serving on the vessel. As the war goes on, there's also a push for them to receive portions of the prizes that they take. But the problem with that is the Continental Congress wants the money from the prizes that are taken from the Continental Navy because they need the money and they need the supplies. Whereas privateers, they don't have to give any of their prize to the Continental Congress. They're commissioned by the Congress or by a state government, but they don't owe anything to the Congress or that government when they come back into port. The Continental Navy does. The Continental Navy owes part of their prize or all of their prize based on their commission to the Continental Congress.
So how are people making the choice to be a sailor or a privateer? Seafarers throughout the colonies were faced with a few options. Enlist in the Continental Navy, something steady, a bit like signing on with a long-term employer, or join a privateer vessel, which is closer to freelancing at sea. Same basic skill set, very different deal. Privateering cruises were shorter and more flexible. They were signing up for 3 to 6 month long cruises, usually. And if a privateering voyage captured even a single valuable prize ship, the payout could far exceed what a Navy sailor earned in the same amount of time. But there's a trade-off. Privateering is high risk, high reward. No captured ships meant no pay at all. The Continental Navy, at least in theory, offered regular wages along with longer-term benefits like pensions. Still, many sailors were drawn to the potential windfall of privateering, which made it difficult for the Navy to recruit and retain crews.
Scholars argue it's patriotism versus not having patriotism, which I don't think is necessarily fair to privateers. Maybe I'm a little protective of them because I've spent years of my life studying them, and so I feel like they're my peeps. But during the Revolution, they are viewed as profiteers, those who are on privateers. This idea that they are operating for profit, that they don't have the cause at heart, that they aren't true patriots, that they basically will jump ship from one venture to another based on what they get out of it. The idea is that, well, the Navy is more patriotic in a sense. And this is something that Isaac Hopkins, that even George Washington, that John Paul Jones were all lamenting, is this fact that the issue the Continental Navy has from day one is, how do we get butts on the boats? How do we get men into our vessels? Because they have these other options, and these other options seem better. They're more lucrative. There's better payout potentially. Now, the one thing that the Navy has that privateers don't have is, in theory, sailors in the Continental Navy are paid on a schedule. So no matter what prize you do or do not capture in a naval vessel, you are supposed to be paid. That's not true for privateer ventures. But I think for the average colonist, the average maritime sailor, there's a pull from privateering, and the Continental Navy struggles with it continuously.
So let's look more into the people that made the choice to serve in the Continental Navy, starting with exactly how many men are we talking? The number of men aboard a naval ship varied widely, depending on the vessel's size and firepower. Large, first-rate ships of the line, the biggest warships with over 100 guns and 3 decks, typically carried 600 to 800 men. However, these were not the majority of ships in service. Most vessels, especially in a fledgling navy like the Continental Navy, were much smaller. Crew size was closely tied to the number of cannons, since each gun required about 3 men to operate. Typical ships might have around 80 to 100 men, while even smaller vessels could have about 50 men. And privateering ships sometimes carried as few as 30 men. In 1782, the British Navy had over 123,000 men, while the Continental Navy had a maximum of about 3,500 men. So with that stark difference in mind, it's important to look beyond the numbers and examine who made up the Continental Navy. During the war, men from a wide range of backgrounds, even those with no seafaring experience, came to the Continental Navy. These vessels drew in poor laborers and skilled professionals alike.
There are poor whites that are serving on Continental vessels, people who are looking, again, for the opportunity because The economy has been completely disrupted during the war. They're looking for ways to earn money for their families. And we know of men who have no maritime experience who decide, I'm going to sign up on a ship. They don't want to serve in the Continental Army for one reason or another, maybe because they're in the South and the Continental Army is in the North. So they decide that they're going to sign up on a Continental Naval vessel and they serve in that capacity. Ships are always looking for surgeons or for doctors to serve. So there are some surgeons, some doctors who sign up to serve on Continental Naval vessels that way. So they're coming from all walks of life, from all areas of society, and then they find themselves on a ship and like they have to work together, which is also crazy if you think about it. They're like thrown together and it's like, here you go, you're going to be on this ship for months. Hope you get along, you know?
Importantly, the Continental Navy was a space where African-American men were welcomed in ways they often were not on the land.
The Continental Navy and privateers as well are more of an, I don't want to say equal, equal is not the right word, but more of a level playing field here in the sense that because they are so desperate for sailors, they are willing to allow African-Americans to serve. They're willing to allow enslaved people to serve, especially in state navies. So Virginia's state navy is known for this. Virginia's state navy allows enslaved African Americans to serve because those enslaved persons have knowledge that the Navy needs.
Open now at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, Unbound. Free Black Virginians, an exhibition tracing the lives of free Black Virginians from 1619 to the end of slavery in 1865. Discover how these individuals claimed their freedom, built thriving communities, and navigated a society that called them free but not equal. Learn more and get tickets at virginiahistory.org.
Because of the tobacco trade, because of the way that Virginia's economy worked and how they moved goods from the interior of the state to the coast, there were pilots who had extensive knowledge of the rivers, of the bays, of the backwaters, who understood shoals, who understood tides, who understood moving sands. And so it made perfect sense for the Virginia Navy and the Continental Navy to allow these enslaved men to serve. And not only enslaved men, but also we know of some free Blacks who chose to serve because the knowledge that they have makes the difference. The British are coming into the Chesapeake, for example, and the maps that they have aren't great. Right. They don't have Google Maps. They don't have GPS. They don't have an atlas that they can look through to be like, where does the tide come in at this point? The maps that they have are OK, but they're not great. And they don't have pilots at the very beginning with that knowledge. As the war goes on, they start trying to draw in either loyalists or they try to capture, take prisoner pilots with that knowledge and then force them, impress them into service in the British Navy. So we are seeing various peoples serving aboard these naval vessels during the war. And it's interesting because it's not only that they serve, but the sources that we have about how their fellow sailors viewed them show that many white sailors appreciated the efforts and the knowledge that these enslaved and free Black sailors brought to the Virginia State Navy, for example. Now, that's not to say that they're not still racist. They are. I mean, that should be a given, but they are. And they clearly do not view them as the same as themselves or really equal to themselves, but they do appreciate the efforts that these men bring to the war. And we have examples of enslaved African Americans in the post-war period who are either seeking freedom or who are seeking recognition for the work that they've done. It's interesting, following the revolution, the Virginia General Assembly passes a law that says that if you were an enslaved African American who served in the Navy, the state Navy, basically as a proxy for your owner. So if your owner was supposed to serve and they sent you instead, they granted freedom to those enslaved African Americans, which is, in a sense, if you think about it, that's huge. That's a really big deal because Southern colonies are not freeing slaves left and right in the 1780s. The difference, though, is if you were a white owner, an enslaver, who sent an enslaved person to serve in the state Navy, not as a proxy for you, but simply as somebody to serve, so then you could collect their payment and the dues that they were owed, that enslaved African American was not freed necessarily because it wasn't a proxy service. It was basically an enslaver taking their so-called property and putting it to use in service of the state Navy or the Continental Navy. The Virginia General Assembly does some good things, but there's also this like gray area where, well, it had to be in a very specific way that the enslaved person was serving.
We spend a lot of time talking about the stories of people who served in the Continental Army, but there are also some really deserving stories coming out of the Continental Navy. Let's learn their names.
Caesar Tarrant was an enslaved African American in Virginia. He ends up serving as a pilot in the Virginia Navy. He served aboard the ship Patriot, and many of his fellow sailors noted his heroic actions, his meritorious service. They end up engaging in 1778 with a British privateer, and he pilots them through the entire engagement. But unfortunately, at the end of the war, he is returned to his enslaver. He is returned to his owner. And it takes him years, basically, him and fellow sailors of his petitioning the state government, the Virginia state government. They want the government to grant his freedom. They end up passing a statute to purchase his freedom in recognition of this meritorious service that he gave. And so he's one example, but there are others who served with him. There's Captain Starlins. He's another Native African who he was trained as a pilot. He ends up dying during the war, but he served on the Patriot as well. There's a free Black named Joseph Ranger of Elizabeth City County who served in the Virginia State Navy, and he chose to serve. He signed up in 1776, and we're not 100% sure why, because he was free, so he wasn't forced to enlist, but he chose to, and he serves on four different vessels, and he continues serving in the Virginia State Navy until 1787. And so in some ways, it's like, well, the state Navy offered him an opportunity to serve the country that he felt he was a part of as a free Black in Virginia. John Paul Jones is really interesting, too, right? As a member of the Navy, he hates privateers with a fiery passion. He says public virtue is not the characteristic of the concerned in privateers. And he says, unless private interest of individuals in our Navy is made superior to that in privateers, the Navy can never become respectable. It never will become formidable. And he says, without a respectable Navy, alas, America. So yeah, John Paul Jones is all about the Navy. And he hates privateers, hates them, just can't stand them.
While the Continental Navy never really gets up off the ground in the way that Adams had sort of envisioned or hoped, there are some key moments where it was vital to the war.
I hesitate to mention him because I know that people don't like him because at the end of the war, he's a traitor. But at the beginning of the war, Benedict Arnold is actually somebody that we should applaud and praise because of the actions that he takes. So he is in October of 1776, so a year after the Continental Navy has officially been formed. He is on Lake Champlain, and he is going up against a British fleet under a guy named Carleton. He basically has two water engagements with Carleton's fleet, one off of Valcour Island on October 11th and one off of Split Rock on October 13th. And what Arnold does is, again, he doesn't have huge ships. He doesn't have this big navy to fall back on. So he constructs a fleet of small vessels. They're basically like smaller galley vessels. And he keeps Carleton engaged. Even though he ends up basically losing both battles, he keeps Carleton's fleet there on Lake Champlain, and he forces the British to kind of bring in a larger fleet, to build a larger fleet, and ends up delaying their attack on Fort Ticonderoga until the following spring. And because of that, that kind of messes up the British plans of like their three-prong attack. And then that leads to Saratoga in the fall of 1777, which Arnold is also part of, where Horatio Gates is, you know, big victor, Battle of Saratoga, the Americans win, Burgoyne has to surrender in all his military glory to the mud-splattered Gates.
On the other hand, it also falls flat a few times.
For example, at the beginning of the war, when Isaac Hopkins is made commander, he is given instructions that he is actually supposed to sail to the Chesapeake, and he is supposed to engage British naval forces off the Chesapeake. Hopkins decides that he doesn't want to do that, probably because he's concerned that he won't win off the Chesapeake. So he takes a piece of his instructions that basically says, if you don't think that this is going to work out well, you're allowed to continue down to the Bahamas, basically, down to the Caribbean. And Hopkins goes, okay. And so he just sails right past the Chesapeake, does not engage with the British at all, and goes down to Nassau because he thinks that he will be more successful there. So there are moments for the Continental Navy where they have the opportunity to engage, but they don't engage. And the Continental Congress gets very frustrated with them because of that, because they're not engaging.
Now, when the French join the war on the side of the Americans with the Treaty of Alliance in 1778, they essentially take over the naval engagements. And thank goodness.
At the beginning of the war, the British Navy, it has about 250 ships. By the end of the war, it's almost doubled. The French Navy is similar to the British Navy. And this is why the French Navy coming in the treaty in 1778 is so important, because they bring in the firepower and the fleet power that the Americans lack. So by 1782, I want to say that they are comparable.
One of the most well-known and biggest engagements in the Chesapeake was the Battle of the Capes in 1781. And it wasn't even really a Continental Navy engagement. It was the French fleet.
When it does come to the big moment in the Chesapeake, it's not the Continental Navy that engages the British. It is the French fleet. So in September of 1781, the British have 19 ships of the line under Admiral Thomas Graves. And the French are under the Admiral Comte de Grasse. A first-rate ship will have three decks with 100 guns and a bunch of men on board. Third-rate ships carry 74 guns. I mean, these are like big ships that we're talking about here. So the British have 19 ships of the line. The French have 24. So it's Grasse versus Graves here. So there is no Continental Navy involved, really. And they engage in battle. They're deadlocked for hours, for several hours. Ultimately, Graves decides to break off. He feels like he's not in the best position, and so he decides to break off from the engagement, and he turns around and he sails back up to New York, which leaves de Grasse there going, yes, we've won. Yay, the French. We have won the Chesapeake. And what that does is Cornwallis is in Yorktown. This is when Cornwallis is waiting for reinforcements. He's waiting for supplies. He's waiting for ammunition that Graves is supposed to be bringing on these ships. And Graves turns and leaves Cornwallis there by himself. Cornwallis picked Yorktown. He wasn't forced into Yorktown. He wasn't told to go to Yorktown. he picked that location, thinking that it would be a good location because it was on the water, it was on the river. And so he thought that, well, this is great. He'd have multiple avenues to get reinforcements and supplies. And it ends up being his downfall, in a sense, because his position allows the American and the French forces basically to surround him, cut him off, and he's left with no option but to surrender. So it is a little, I don't want to say depressing. That's maybe not the right word. It's a little frustrating that the Continental Navy is not involved in this coup de grace, in this big moment for the revolution. Washington knew from the get-go that they were going to need a naval presence. And he knew that the Continental Navy was struggling. He knew that they were going to need help from the French fleet. And he actually writes to Lafayette at one point, and he says, without a decisive naval force, we can do nothing definitive. And with it, everything honorable and glorious. So Washington, he knows. He knows that it might not be the Continental Navy, that it might end up being the French Navy, but it doesn't really matter, because as long as they have that naval support, that gives him what he needs to be successful on land. We all think the American Revolution takes place in the colonies, and it's George Washington and his army versus the British. Truth be told, not to like burst any bubbles here, but once the French enter the war, eventually then the Spanish also enter the war, and then the Dutch come in. So the American Revolution is being fought not only in North America, it's also being fought in Europe. It's being fought in India. It's being fought in the Caribbean. The French and the Spanish have made this, I mean, it has been a global war, but it is even more of a global war. And that too is part of the reason why the British ultimately aren't able to win the war, because they're not just fighting the Americans. They are fighting on multiple fronts. And truth be told, Britain is more concerned about its colonies and territories elsewhere than it is about the U.S. colonies. So at the end of the day, the reason they come to this conclusion and decide to sue for peace and withdraw from the war is because, economically speaking, it makes sense to lose the U.S. colonies in an effort to save their other colonial possessions. It's global, it's international. And to think that it's not, it's one of the things that I talk about in my book on privateers, is that privateers are a huge part of that international aspect of the war. It is an international conflict. And to try to keep it contained to those 13 original colonies kind of does a disservice to those who ultimately fought in the conflict.
At the end of the war, the Continental Navy was effectively disbanded.
The Continental Navy is never really a force to be reckoned with. At most, maybe 60, 65 vessels in the Continental Navy. And again, when you compare that to the nearly 500 vessels in the British Navy at the end of the war, not even close. And a lot of these vessels were converted merchant ships. They're not in the best shape as we get to the end of the war. The Navy has lost a number of vessels. So when it comes to the end of the war, and the question is it worth, in a sense, investing the time and money in keeping a Navy that's not even really a Navy at this point, because there's only like a handful of ships left intact? The answer is basically no. The Continental Congress, which has become the Confederation Congress once the Articles of Confederation are approved, the Confederation Congress is basically like, we need money. And so the last vessel of the Continental Navy is sold for funds for this new nation. And so there really isn't a Navy, per se, not technically speaking. Obviously, there's the spirit of the Navy, as the Navy today would want to tell you. There's the spirit of the Navy. We keep that spirit alive, but there are no naval ships.
The United States establishes a Navy Department in 1798 during the quasi-war with France, but the force remains small and inconsistent. During his presidency, Thomas Jefferson deprioritized naval investment, which left ships neglected. By Madison's presidency and the War of 1812, the Navy was unprepared and once more relied heavily on privateers alongside a modest Navy. Throughout the 19th century, the Navy expanded and contracted, depending on immediate needs. It grew during the American Civil War, but stagnated afterwards. A more permanent shift began at the turn of the century, especially under Theodore Roosevelt, who championed a modern, powerful Navy. From that point forward, through global demonstrations of strength, like the Great White Fleet, and into the World Wars, especially World War II, the U.S. Navy evolved into a major international force.
The Continental Navy is the birth of the U.S. Navy, but the U.S. Navy, as most of your listeners probably know it, is really a 20th century Navy. It is not an 18th or a 19th century Navy.
Thanks so much to Dr. Kylie Holbert for sharing her insights on today's episode. And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us for this bonus episode of Revolution Revisited.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Nicole Martorana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.